This podcast is brought to you by Workle, a platform helping people get happier at work. Find out more at workle.co. Work happier.
I come from a really straightforward, ordinary background. John said, you should come down to the student newspaper, it's quite a laugh. I hadn't really thought about journalism. Something clicked in what this was, journalism. A lot of it is serendipitous. Sometimes it's right place, right moment. Following Blair through the Iraq war was beyond belief. 9/11. At this stage, I was nearing what might be described now as burnout.
Welcome to the Happy Work Life podcast, where people with inspiring careers reflect on how happy they have been in their working lives. On this podcast, we hear from a range of people working in business, startups, science, academia, media, healthcare, fashion, and much more, and find out which roles gave them the most satisfaction and, importantly, what they have done to get happier at work. So, sit down with me, Mark Price, founder of Workle, to help you get happier at work. Workle is the platform where you can find a job in the happiest companies, take our happiness test, network, and get career support from experts, and much, much more. On this edition of the Happy Work Life podcast, I'm delighted to be speaking to Kamal Ahmed. Now, a lot of you might know Kamal from his time at the BBC as the business and then economics reporter. He appeared on the news virtually every night. But before that, he had a distinguished career in newspapers. As you'll discover, he wrote for a number of major newspapers, mainly around business and economic, but also other topics, which you'll be interested to hear about. But after his time as a reporter at the BBC, he went on to management in the BBC and then set up quite recently the News Movement with Will Lewis. The News Movement was their idea to bring news to a younger generation in a way that they could more easily interact with. So Kamal has got an amazing story. He's written a book, which I'll also talk about, which is about his early life. But what we'll find out from Kamal, what it was like to start in journalism, build a career in journalism, and then now ultimately set up his own media empire. Kamal, it's great to be able to speak to you today. And we're already keen to hear about your career. But before we start with your career, let's talk about your early years. Tell us, was journalism in your blood?
Journalism, no, wasn't in my blood. I'm probably not a huge fan of the notion of, you know, I was sort of born to be a journalist, personally. It might work for some people, but no, certainly not for me. I had no familial links into the industry. So it was something that came to me, and I'm sure we'll get to this at some point during our conversation, but it came to me at quite a moment in my time. It was actually at university. But when I started as out on kind of just being a child and growing up, I think I was pretty much like, you know, most kids maybe growing up in the 70s and 80s. I grew up in West London. I remember one of the first jobs I ever thought I wanted to do. We lived under the Heathrow flight path. And so planes were a very big part of how you grew up. And the days that Heathrow had their flight path over your house, you knew about it. And the days they didn't, it was quite peaceful. And I remember from that, Mark, the first thing I can ever remember wanting to be was an air traffic controller. It's because I thought, well, that looks very exciting, air travel. And in those days as well, you still had Concorde. And so it was particularly noisy when Concorde came across, but it all looked quite exciting. So no, journalism wasn't in my blood. The first thing that I can ever remember wanting to be as a young child was an air traffic controller.
And tell me about your school days. Were you a bit of a swot at school? Did you work hard? I mean, what do you remember of school?
So I come from a really straightforward, ordinary background. My mother was a teacher. My father was a research scientist. He worked at Moorfields Eye Hospital. So I came from a background where education was really important, you know, from my mother's and my father's side. My father, sadly dead now, but he came to the UK in the 1960s from Omdurman in Sudan. And he had a very strong notion of you needed to work hard at education to take the opportunities that were before you, and a very similar attitude from my mother. So I was very fortunate that I came from a very normal background, but my mother and father, you know, and lots of people have been through this journey, taught me the value of education and I suppose of working hard. I suppose, Mark, you're right. So sometimes that was called SWAT, being a bit of a SWAT, in a negative sense, which I always find a little disappointing, that working hard is seen as somehow not the cool thing to do. But I went to my local primary school. As I say, I grew up in West London, in sort of really ordinary suburban West London. I went to my local primary school. I went to my local comprehensive, with people of all different talents and mixed abilities. I think that was incredibly useful for my career in journalism, to understand that people came from all sorts of different backgrounds. We had people from the posh parts of Ealing, of which there were many. We had people from the places that weren't so economically strong in the borough. And we all mixed in together. And I think that was really important. And I think the final thing for me was, as a mixed Black man, you had a very different experience from others. Obvious racism was much more rife in the 70s and 80s. I remember the National Front, you know, literally marching down the street, calling for the repatriation of people like me. We weren't that long after the Enoch Powell Rivers of Blood speech era. You had this overhang as a person of color growing up in the UK of that notion that people didn't really believe you either should be here, and if you were here, that you shouldn't have the same opportunities as other people. And I was always very aware of that. And I think that's the immigrant experience. I'm a second generation immigrant, obviously born in the UK, but whose father was from Sudan. I think that's a pretty typical experience of immigrants into the UK, or people who come from immigrant families and immigrant backgrounds, particularly if, as a person of color, that is a very obvious part of your background in the UK. So a very ordinary background, but a background that did instill it in you that working hard was the way you were going to get on. And that was your access to opportunities. So yes, local school, local primary school. I went walked around the corner to my local primary school. My mother still lives in the house I grew up in Ealing, then walked to my local comprehensive, mixed in with everyone. And then to university, I was very fortunate to go and study politics at Leeds University.
And at school, what subjects were you good at? I mean, were you good at English? Did that?
Yes, in those days, Mark, it was much more divided. I'm delighted now, young people now will take mixed approaches to the notion of science and arts. And that mix, I remember the famous Steve Jobs quote that the successful person of the future is a mix of an engineer and an artist. I think in my era, that was less clear. You did one track or the other. You were humanities or science. And I was from that generation where you had that rather cliched notion of I wasn't very good at science or I wasn't very good at maths. I think people are now teaching those subjects in very different ways. And I'm sure I would have had a much more enjoyable journey in those areas, maybe if I'd been at school now. But I was seen to be good in those days at, yes, English, history, essay writing. I used to write in my spare time, you know, poetry. And I loved writing as an art form. And we came from a musical family as well. So I was quite fortunate, you know, through my mother, to be completely normal that we'd have a piano in the house. I had piano lessons. I went to the local music school on Saturday. I played the bassoon. So I was in Ealing Youth Orchestra, which was a wonderful youth orchestra, very, you know, had a very prestigious name in the youth orchestra world. So I was lucky enough to, you know, travel to Europe with the youth orchestra, to play in amazing places, in London in particular with the youth orchestra. So I was very fortunate, particularly for my mother's side. My grandfather was a choir master and an organist. So I was very fortunate to have that. I was good at that sort of art side of the fence, so to speak.
So it sounds as though there were some things in your early years that equipped you for your career in terms of writing, in terms of performing, in terms of feeling confident in front of people.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, Mark. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that. But yes, I was quite used to, yeah, playing. You know, you'd have to. I was very nervous, interestingly, practicing. I was very aware that when I practiced, you could hear if you walked past in the street. So I was very aware and always worried that schoolmates would walk past the front window and see me practicing, you know, the violin, the bassoon, the piano. I find that quite cramping. But you're right, actually, Mark. I got to learn, I suppose, yes, how to perform, how to do exams, how to turn up. And then, yes, in my writing, I did love writing. And my mother, again, you know, introduced me to the joys of books. And my mother would read to me every night, and I would then read myself a huge amount. And so, yes, there are, yes, actually, Mark, yeah, there are some connections there.
And then why did you choose politics, and why did you choose Leeds University?
Horizons then, Mark, were much smaller. We didn't have the internet. We, you know, you watch the world on the telly, maybe you listen to it on the radio, you read it in a newspaper, but it wasn't available in the same way. My daughter's 23, my son is 20. It wasn't available in the same way as it is today, the world. And for me, it was quite adventurous to want to leave London. I was always, you know, we used to go to Yorkshire for holidays. I had family there on my mother's side, so I was very used to that sort of part of the UK. And I was always quite keen on the idea of getting out of London and seeing a different city. I wouldn't have considered a life abroad or anything. You know, now, of course, studying abroad is seen as very ordinary for many, many young people. But for me, that would have been quite a leap. As I say, I was a very ordinary suburban boy. From traveling into London, central London, was a pretty kind of crazy night out, to be honest. So going to Leeds was quite a big adventure. But I always wanted to sort of not get away from London, but to experience something different. I remember, I think I applied to Sheffield, Leeds, Liverpool, Manchester from memory. And politics, I was always fascinated by politics. I read a huge amount. The Kinnocks were well known in our area. Neil Kinnock lived, and his family lived, just around the corner from where we lived in Ealing. Or had a house there, obviously not a constituency house, but his London home. Stephen and Rachel Kinnock went to my school. I think Stephen was the year or two below me, and Rachel, I think, is a little younger again. So we sort of could see, you know, politics sort of in real life almost. And that created sort of a passion in me. I also remember there was a teacher at my school in sixth form who took British government. I didn't take British government as A-level, but it was an option. And I remember Mr. Crow, his name was. I remember him speaking to me, asking me why I hadn't taken it, because I was obviously interested in politics. I used to follow politics a lot. I would generally be that person who watched the party conference speeches from all the main parties. I would be that person. Wasn't quite William Hague, but wasn't far off my engagement with politics. And Mr. Crow said to me, "I'm really surprised, Kamal, that you didn't take government as an A-level." And I must admit, Mark, it was a bit of ignorance. I took English, history and geography as my A-levels because they were sort of in front of me and I was quite good at them. And it was he put in my mind, you should think about doing politics at university. And I went up and did actually, I took geography initially. And then again, it shows this issue, Mark, of often an individual will frame something for you as a young person that changes your route. And I took geography initially at Leeds and politics as my minor because of what Mr. Crow had said to me. And one of the postgraduate teachers at, when you did your minor in politics, you had the postgrads would teach you some of the basics of that side of your academic career at Leeds. And she took me aside and said, "Kamal, I feel you're really, I'm not sure she said really good at this, but really engaged in politics. You know, I knew the arguments. I loved reading the initial texts, whether that was Hegel or Locke or Marx or whoever it was. I feel you're really infused by this. Have you thought of changing degree?" And literally, Mark, just like Mr. Crow, I kind of said, no. Okay, can I do that? And she said, well, you can, and I think you should. And it was that conversation maybe halfway through my first year at Leeds when I was actually majoring in geography that again changed the trajectory for me, because getting back to the journalism bit, it was that move where I met again a very singular person in my kind of life's journey, which I think is so important for people, a guy called John Rigby. John is still a senior editor. He's now a senior editor at the BBC. And John was on the politics course. And I was slightly in my second year casting around for something to do because, you know, I've been to Freshers' Fair. I've done a bit of this and that. I thought I was quite good at athletics, but I wasn't good enough to do it at university level. So I was slightly cast around. John said, you should come down to the student newspaper. It's quite a laugh. And I said, yeah, okay, John, I'll come down. I hadn't really thought about journalism. I was kind of still in that space of, oh, I might be a lawyer. Oh, maybe I'm going to be a politician. And I went down, Mark, to Leeds student newspaper. It was in the basement in the Polytechnic, which was then the Polytechnic, because it was a joint product from the university and then what was then called the Polytechnic. It was in a basement bar. You walked in. There were pints of half-drunk beer with fags stuck out in them, you know, in the olden days when you could smoke inside. You know, it's pretty dank, pretty rough place. And I walked in, Mark, and then something clicked in what this was, journalism, this notion of trying to inform your audience about what the university was up to, what it should be doing. I remember writing my first article, doing my first headline, and suddenly realizing, Mark, wow, this is a thing. This is really important. It brought together my enthusiasm and passion for politics. As you said, Mark, I loved writing, the power of words. And then I suppose a values piece, Mark, for me, you know, my values were, how do you empower people? I went to a very ordinary school and I saw the differential. You know, at my school, very few Black students took A-levels. My school was a third and a third and a third. A third white pupils, a third mostly South Asian pupils, and a third Black, mostly Caribbean heritage pupils. When you got to sixth form, it was half-half white and South Asian heritage. A lot of Black pupils in those days were so appallingly treated by the education system, not my school particularly. But Steve McQueen went to my school, the artist. He was a couple of years below me, and he's spoken about his experience in school as a young Black man who wanted to be a director and a creator. And I think the values that instilled in me, that somehow, as I would frame it in my younger days, life wasn't fair and why was that, was an important part of what I grew up with. And realize and could see starkly in front of me, some people have succeeded not because of the wit of their brain, but because of their background. That seemed wrong to me. And journalism was an empowering thing that helped you tell stories in different ways and help people navigate the world and be informed. And suddenly I realized that journalism was my home to make the difference to the world that I felt I wanted to make a difference in.
And you started your journalistic career in Scotland.
There were two of the big journalism schools in the UK were City and Cardiff. There were others as well, which were brilliant and actually have come to the fore much more. But the two all of us wanted to get into was one of those two. I was very, very fortunate to get into City, onto the City newspaper course. And I met a wonderful person there and we were together. And she got a job at BBC Scotland, super, super smart. And I was very glad to follow her. I still had that slight thing. The city obviously was London. So I was back to London. And I still had that slight, wasn't that adventurous. I thought at the time it was super adventurous going to Leeds. And then obviously doubly super adventurous to go to Glasgow, where BBC Scotland is headquartered. So she got a job there and I followed. And just a little story about my first job. Into journalism, my first sort of proper job. I did apply for the BBC trainee scheme, failed to get that. So anyone who's listening to this, failure is not an issue, I hope. Shouldn't be an issue for you. So I failed to get that, but I did probably a quite clever thing. I don't often do clever things, but this was possibly one of them. They said, so sorry, Kamal, you've not been successful. You know, would you like feedback? So yes, please have the feedback. Always take the feedback. I think that's always useful for you. And I asked who had got the job. And they told me who had got the job. And what I did, Mark, I wrote to the newspaper that person was going to be leaving in the future. I just wrote them a letter, very old school, wrote them a letter and said, hi, I'm Kamal Ahmed. I am a student journalist. I've done City University. I would love to come and see if I could work out at your newspaper, a small newspaper just outside Glasgow in a place called Dumbarton, the Lennox Herald. They got my letter. Yes, thanks so much for writing. No opportunities at the moment, but we'll keep your letter on file, the usual answer. But then, of course, a couple of days later, one of their reporters announced to the paper he was leaving to join the trainee scheme at the BBC. And the editor thought, oh, didn't we just get a letter in from someone saying, you've got any jobs going? Oh, well, we have. Let's get back to him. And so it was rather fortunate that journey, rather than taking, oh, I haven't got the BBC job, that's a bit depressing, and being a bit depressed. And I think this is one thing which I've maybe been quite good at. I thought, okay, what's the next line? What do I do with this rather than just going, oh, I feel a bit sad. Okay, find out who, there's going to be an opening somewhere because someone's going to leave their job to do this job. Why don't I go for that thing and see if I can get there? And actually it worked. And I got my first job in Scotland at the wonderful Lennox Herald as a local journalist.
What came next? So you've moved to Scotland. You've started as a reporter on a local paper. Take us from there.
So I loved it. And again, it was all about, I covered the council. It was a very divided council. So there was lots of very interesting, you know, work to cover. It was always about trying to serve your audience, which was the residents of Dumbarton, the Vale of Leven, Alexandra, Helensburgh. Those are our local towns in our area. The paper was nearly 150 years old. You know, it was in the community, you know, there's the guy from the Lennox. People would literally come up to you in the high street and say, hey, you should put this in the Lennox. And I learned a huge amount in my 2 years there from doing my first, horrible phrase, Mark, but your first death knock where a family member has died and you go and interview the family, right through to Jason Donovan came and did a concert on the banks of Loch Lomond. Being able to interview Jason Donovan when he was really a thing was very, very exciting. So you did everything in your patch. And then I was lucky because there, again, looking maybe for the pivot or the next opportunity, we were in our patch was the Clyde submarine base. So that was the new nuclear subs where Trident was arriving on the Clyde in the time I was there. This is the 1990s. And I realized that was a national story. So I was at a local paper, but had a national event on my doorstep. And I ensured that I made great contacts at the base, great contacts in politics. There was the peace camp, Faslane peace camp. The whole tone of that was very, very important. And as well as doing lots of stories for the Lennox Herald, I also made sure I did stories for the Evening Times in Glasgow, the Glasgow Herald, and then Scotland on Sunday. And it was by doing that Scotland on Sunday sort of spotted me. And then again, these things are serendipitous, aren't they, Mark, so often in life. The Windsor Castle fire happened, and Scotland on Sunday needed someone in London. The news editor of Scotland on Sunday knew I was from London and asked whether I would, I think it happened on a Friday, that was a Sunday paper. They needed someone in London. Could I get down there? So I jumped in my old VW Polo, drove down to London overnight. My mother lived in West London near Windsor, quite not near Windsor, but, you know, on the right side of London at least. So I got to my mum's, I remember it's sort of 5 o'clock in the morning, washed my face, drove to Windsor, and then filed all day from the Windsor fire for Scotland on Sunday. I remember I had an old fashioned battery phone with the battery you carried. First time I'd ever seen a mobile phone. Then Scotland on Sunday, quite shortly after that, offered me a job to come and join them. I think show a bit of maybe, I don't like talking, I suppose, about myself, because I think all of us have got this inside us. But I suppose it was that notion, I think entrepreneurial spirit maybe is right. I wanted to do well. I had this sort of drive that no one was going to hold me back. And I seemed to be pretty good at seeing opportunities. So like the Clyde base, I could see that was an opportunity to do journalism on a wider canvas. So that got me into Scotland Sunday.
And then?
Well, and then from there, the editor of Scotland Sunday then became the editor of The Observer in London. And actually, I went down to speak to him. And through that, I got connected into the Guardian Media Group. I was at the Lennox Herald, I think, for a couple of years, Scotland Sunday for two and a half years. I was very fortunate. I won some awards in Scotland, for the journalism, you know, we did there. I led on, but, you know, obviously without the paper, you don't have anything. So I was very fortunate. I became, as a very young journalist, I was what, 24, 25, as a young journalist, I became a little bit known. I won Young Journalist of the Year and some other awards. And so I was noticed a bit in London. And Scotland Sunday won Paper of the Year as well. So we all came down to London. And again, people were noticing Scotland Sunday. They've got a good roster of people. I had great colleagues, Rory Nicol, Ewan Ferguson, you know, Ray Clancy, you know, many others. We were making a bit of noise. Scotland Sunday was growing fast. We were nipping at the heels of the Sunday Times in Scotland. And so Andrew Jasperman then became the editor of The Observer. He was the editor of Scotland Sunday. He invited me down for a chat. That didn't quite work out, but they were looking for a royal correspondent. And I think in those days, this was at The Guardian. And I think at those days, there was still a slight notion of, why do you cover the royals? I think this was just at the time of the divorce, at the time of the Martin Bashir interview. It was just, the royal family were moving out of that zone where some papers were a bit snobbish about covering the royals and why are we covering the royals and that isn't it just a soap opera, to becoming really significant. And they were looking for a new royal correspondent. By then I was chief reporter at the Scotland Sunday. That's the main lead reporter on the big story of the week. So I'd just done a big piece. I think it was on the Martin Bashir interview, from memory. This is all quite a long time ago, apologies. And Alan Rusbridger, who was then the editor of The Guardian, had seen that and asked me in for a chat and asked me whether that would be interesting for me as to become the royal correspondent at The Guardian. And I had to keep myself in my seat and not just punch the air in complete delight that I was given this opportunity. My mum had read The Guardian, The Observer her whole life. I'd had it in the house my whole life. I'd read those papers my whole life. And that gave me the in into The Guardian as their royal correspondent. And Mark, goodness me, I was suddenly, obviously with the death of Diana, Princess of Wales, shortly after, I was on the biggest story of the decade, if not the second half of the century almost. So again, Mark, lessons I'm supposing, you know, is what we'd love to get out of this conversation we're having. Yeah, being on it, looking for the pivots, being entrepreneurial, being your best self and working as hard. I worked as hard as I physically could, sometimes to the detriment of my work-life balance, and I think that's worth just noting here. But also, a lot of it is serendipitous. Sometimes it's right place, right moment. And I say right in an awful sense, because of course it was appalling what happened, but suddenly I was working 18 hours a day. You almost didn't sleep through that period. I remember my colleague, Luke Harding, who's now one of the most esteemed Russia, particularly Russia experts on The Guardian and obviously a very famous author now. But Luke and I, he joined from the Mail and I joined from Scotland Sunday within a week of each other and we sat together. And Luke and I, you know, became, you know, firm friends through that period. And we worked on the Diana copy for the paper. And you just didn't stop. You just didn't stop. And so, again, I was just there. And that led to sort of those next opportunities.
And reflections on being a royal correspondent, favourite story?
Your favourite is difficult. I remember doing the first trip to Dhaka with then Prince Charles and just being amazed at the way you travelled as the royal, you know, private jet, you know, the monogrammed foot slippers. For me, I grew up in a two up, two down house in West Ealing, you know. I remember that, going to Dhaka on that was probably my first really big foreign trip with a pack. I'd done big foreign trips with Scotland Sunday, but with a pack, I think that was fascinating. And going to Dhaka, that was the first time I'd ever been to Bangladesh, and you know, it was amazing. That was amazing. Obviously, I wouldn't use the word favorite, but doing covering what the death of Diana, Princess of Wales, meant was an amazing experience. I was very fortunate to go to the funeral, and I remember as her coffin was brought in, because she was going to be in a mausoleum, she was in a lead-lined coffin, and the soldiers who carried her, it's incredibly heavy, obviously, the soldiers who carried her, I remember seeing the sort of sweat and the effort of carrying her up the aisle at Westminster Abbey. And the tavern, I think it was Taverner, wasn't it, that was playing. And the emotion of the weight, not just of her actual coffin and herself, but the weight of her image seemed to be there in that moment. And that was a remarkable experience. And still, Mark, I think I was still in my 20s. This had all happened before I'd hit 30, you know. It was an era of expansion. We had been in the media, we'd been through the Murdoch revolution, the breaking of many closed shops, bad working practices, and that had led to this flourishing of media in the 90s. It was a real period of expansion, and I was very lucky to be able to surf that. I was then, you know, having a wonderful time at The Guardian. I became the media editor. Media editor of The Guardian was one of the kind of, you know, Rolls-Royce positions. It was a very powerful section. It was a must-read in the media industry in the UK and beyond. So I was very fortunate then. I think I was about 30 then, I think. And then they asked me to become political editor at The Observer. I mean, and given, you know, my history, my love of politics, my desire to be in that kind of space, again, I was incredibly fortunate. I don't want to be sort of falsely humble. I believe I was good at what I did. I worked incredibly hard. I had great colleagues who helped me. And so, yes, political editor of The Observer. And then from that, to become head of news at The Observer and go through the relaunch of The Observer, the amazing period The Observer went through. We won Newspaper of the Year. Yeah, it was an incredible time. I had an amazing years at The Guardian, amazing years at The Observer. You know, following Blair through the Iraq War was beyond belief. 9/11. You just have these amazing moments, Mark, in a career, in my career, in a career in journalism, if you are fortunate enough to be successful in what is it's a pretty brutal competitive business. At this stage, I was nearing what might be described now as burnout. And just being very honest with you, Mark, the work-life balance was not working. And I think all of us should think about that. I've been very fortunate in the relationships I have had in my life, in my personal life. I have not put enough into considering what work-life balance is. And I was getting to burnout. I was working so many hours and people around me couldn't cope. And I tried to make a decision to re-engage differently, following my values, but re-engage differently. So I went to the Equality and Human Rights Commission. Of course, then I was quite well known that the change program for The Observer became a bit of a case study. And lots of organizations came to me saying, could you come and do the same at X, at Y, and Z? And the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which was a new organization, came to me. And Trevor Phillips was the chair. Nicola Brewer was the chief executive. And it was a very exciting project, a new way of reimagining how we have debates about fairness and equity. Right back, this is what I can remember from my school days, you know, same conversation. And I thought, yes, and this will give me a chance to reset myself in work, Monday to Friday rather than 7 days a week, you know, and try and rethink how you're having relationships with your partners. I then had two children. Who are amazing people, obviously. So that was the reset in the Equality and Human Rights Commission. And then from there, the journalistic itch, Mark, was just too strong. And yes, again, very fortunately, Will Lewis, very old friend of mine, I was at City University with him all those years ago. He asked me if I'd go and help him in his journey transforming the Telegraph Group, which he was already doing to great effect. And he asked me if I would join him and help him reimagine business and economics coverage at that group.
So you did that and were hugely successful, Kamal. I think that's probably the time that I first got to know you, when you were at the Telegraph doing those roles. But then you got the call from the BBC to go and be their primary journalist for business and then for economics. So how did that come about? Because it's very different being sort of anonymous in a sense behind the name in a paper and being on the 9 o'clock news or the 10 o'clock news, whatever it is and was.
That's certainly true, Mark. Yeah, and as you say, Mark, it's when we first met and started discussing. So, you know, thank you for your support through those kind of periods. The move from politics to business was a big move. But I've always had these underlying notions of skill sets. Skill sets are actually the same. Openly curious. I've never been tribal. Think about your audience first. What do they need to know? What can help them? So the journalistic skill sets, whether you're the political editor, whether you're the head of news, whether you're the business and economics editor of the Telegraph, whether you're the business editor of the BBC or the economics editor of the BBC or the political editor of the BBC, should actually be quite similar. And I think if you have learned those skills and you have been successful, so I've done royals, media, politics, and then head of news, and then business and economics. You know, the BBC job, Robert Peston was moving on from the business editor job to the economics editor's job. And the job was advertised. And I had done a little bit of television, you know, as business editor at the Telegraph, but also at The Observer. And I liked it. I liked doing broadcasting. I liked the impact it had. You know, journalists usually have egos, you know, and I'm not shy to say I probably had a bit of that. As you say, Mark, I was a bit of a performer throughout my career, sometimes to great criticism, but there we are. So when the job was there, speaking to my then partner, you know, she said, look, you should go for it. You know, it's a great opportunity. There is no more powerful role than working for such the world's largest news organization and the most respected and most trusted news organization. What's journalism? It's about creating impact. If you can create impact with the way you cover things, then try and do it. And I had a notion, I think, again, maybe helpful for maybe some of the listeners. I've always been very clear when I go for new roles, new jobs, new ideas, what is sort of Kamal bringing to this? So I had a very clear notion of what business coverage should be like. I was very lucky to have known Jeff Randall, for he'd obviously been a brilliant business editor at the BBC. I'd known Jeff Randall when he was editor of the Sunday Business, a new paper. And Jeff had been always a very good, you know, contact for me and a very good friend. We used to go for dinner together. I was very much on the Jeff side, the kind of Jeff side of the fence. The BBC needs to take business seriously and not always see it as a problem. And Greg Dyke had introduced that when he was Director General of the BBC, and Jeff had really lived that. He was that business editor who really personified that idea, and I really believed in that. James Harding was the Director of News. He had come from the Times as the editor. I knew James a bit. You just tend to know people, you know. He was media editor of the FT when I was media editor of the Guardian. And I made it very clear in the interview, this is what I wanted to do. I think I could communicate clearly. And I wanted business to be something that people understood as the lifeblood of any democracy that's based on capitalism. And I hope, and well, obviously, you know, I was successful in that very tough process. I hope that's what they wanted to hire, and I hope I did a little bit of that in the job.
And did you enjoy working for the BBC as a reporter?
Loved it. A great privilege. Look, Mark, I don't want to overplay this, and it's a very small violin, but I came from a very ordinary background with no journalistic network, you know, from my family. And suddenly I was business editor of the BBC, and as you say, on the 10 o'clock news. I mean, literally. And then economics through the Brexit referendum, business editor through the Scottish independence referendum, these were huge, huge moments. I mean, I'd done the financial crisis at the Telegraph, and that was huge. This was different order. You know, you are in people's living rooms. You have to be super respectful of the institution you work for and of the audiences you serve. And how do you best try and do that? And I had a very clear idea on that. But look, I was hugely helped by Robert. I was hugely helped by the BBC's economics and business teams. What a fantastic bunch of people. I've been very blessed, Mark, in my career. And I don't know, Mark, I'm sure, you know, I would love, you know, your reflections. I should interview you for another podcast. You need to be surrounded by great people, because the public at the BBC, the public see the tip of the iceberg, and that tip of the iceberg looks like Kamal Ahmed in business. But there's a big iceberg underneath there who are all working incredibly hard to keep you doing the right thing. Teamwork is essential to great broadcasting. I loved it. The downside, if I can maybe sense where your next question is coming from, I found the public-facing side of it and actually becoming a bit famous tiring and wearing, and your public life being open to scrutiny, your private life, sorry, being open to scrutiny. And it got to the stage where you did get to the stage where you were recognized pretty much everywhere. I mean, through the referendum, I was on air, the referendum campaign, Brexit, I was on air all the time. Through the election campaigns, of which there were myriad, I was on air all the time. So millions of people would be seeing you every day. And look, as I say, these are tiny violins, Mark, but that was a tiring journey. I found after 5 years, that was enough. That was enough. I didn't want to be a famous journalist. I wanted to be a good journalist. And I think I saw that there was an opportunity to help shape some of the future planning of the BBC under Tony Hall, who had a great modernization program for that place. And he asked, I applied and for the director of news job when James left, didn't get that, wasn't ready, frankly, to get that job, but wanted to apply, wanted to put myself forward. Another maybe quite small lesson from this, don't worry about applying for jobs you're not quite qualified for, because you don't know where those tracks will end. And this was a real case in point. I applied to be director of news, probably one job too far for me, frankly, but I had a lot of experience in different areas. But actually, Tony then asked, would I join the news board, BBC News Board, as editorial director and help shape the future of news within the BBC, within his whole modernization process for the BBC? And that gave me an opportunity to support the BBC News in its modernization program.
And I can remember having a conversation with you, Kamal, when you said to me that you wanted to move to the other side of the camera, and that you wanted to move into management and organisation, which at the time struck me as quite a big pivot. But you did that and you were very successful. But take us on from there to setting up now your new organisation, which is bring the news to a younger generation. So tell us about how that came about and what you're trying to achieve now with your new business, your new venture.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. I'd forgotten, of course, you helped me. I think mentors are really important. And Mark, I've always been very fortunate to have you as somebody who's guided me. And I think those kind of conversations are really important from outside your sector, I think is really vital. I've always had a number of people around me who have been very helpful in those types of conversations. You could tell there was a signal that we were all seeing in the sector, the media sector. I'll speak about the media sector first. We were seeing a signal that the system of the creation of journalism was not engaging certain audiences. And one set of audiences that were particularly not coming to the type of what might be described as traditional journalism that I'd grown up with were young people. And the Reuters Institute reports, which is one of the Bibles for anyone involved in the media, comes out of Oxford University, is brilliantly run. Fantastic expert there, Nick Newman, who is one of the kind of gods of research in the media industry in the UK and around the world. he had revealed that one of the fastest growing audience sets within the media, within media consumption, was news avoiders, people who are literally not engaging with the news. Now, Mark, my passion has always been people should be informed by trusted, accurate, non-partisan journalism that is useful for you to navigate the world. Well, if people were turning away from the news, as a journalist, you needed to think about that, because if journalism dies, democracy dies. And, you know, I am driven by values as well as ambition and ego and all the other things that we're all driven by, and passion for your job and et cetera. And if journalism is not there for my daughter who's 23, for my son who is 20, then that's a problem for all of us. And Will and I, you know, we'd worked together at the Telegraph. We'd been friends for 30 plus years. Had been talking about this for many years, actually. It'd gone right back a decade, really. We'd having this conversation. And we got to that stage in our careers where we could do something. I think as if you are fortunate enough to get to privileged positions, I suppose, how do you use those positions to do something, which to solve a problem? And Will and I, and without Will, the news movement would not exist. Will and I were both in a position to slightly think, okay, can we do something together? Will started it, and then he asked me to, would I join and reimagine editorial for this next generation of consumers and of employees and of citizens? And I must admit, Mark, and I don't know what you found with your, you know, setting up your brilliant business, it was actually a decision I made in literally a 30-minute phone call. You sort of feel there must be this massive origin story, and I grappled with it overnight and I had sleepless nights. And I remember Will called me and I was in my bedroom at home overlooking. I have a flat in East London. It was overlooking Hackney Fields. I remember it vividly. And Will was saying, well, this is what I'm trying to do. We've talked about this. You're interested in this. I'd given him some advice already. And then he said, you know, would you be interested? And I sort of then and there said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. They had made some posts redundant at the BBC. But the BBC had been incredibly generous. They had offered me many, many different opportunities to plan for the future of that great organization. I'd had some other options. I'd almost accepted a CEO's job, actually, Mark. I don't know if we spoke through that period. I'm sure we probably did. And Will said, no, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. Stay in journalism. It's outside journalism. Stay in journalism. Let's do this. And I sort of said yes. And the main reason, actually, my partner is a lawyer, but she started her own business when she was 29. And she said, if you don't do it now, Kamal, you will always regret it. You've got a chance to do something. And as you know, Mark, you know, we've both been on, you know, maybe some similar journeys over the last few years to, you know, in terms of building a new business. Just start, because it won't be perfect. You can't plan how you are an entrepreneur. You have to have a strong hypothesis, which we did have, about storytelling can change, and therefore we can engage young people in the business of journalism and why it matters. And you need to be able to manage the notion of risk of just starting and seeing what happens. And we had a little bit of seed funding, which we'd put together ourselves. So we knew we had a shortish runway where we could keep going with maybe about 10 of us, a few more. We needed to raise. And I just decided, my partner said, if not now, it'll be never, and you'll always regret it. This was an opportunity to solve a problem that was very obvious. How do we create the next generation of news for the next generation of consumers, delivered in the main where our audience is, and that's on social media?
And it's brilliant, Kamal. I mean, the news movement, I've signed up. I think that the way that you tell the news, the stories, is really compelling. And you've got brilliant young journalists. So it's amazing to see the way in which you've grown a whole new media empire. What surprised you about the journey? What's been hard and what's been most rewarding based on all the other things you've done?
It is a very tough job. Starting your own business, when you start, you have to do everything from, you know, and then, of course, raising money as well. These were all new skills that I had to learn. Will had been through a lot of this himself. I was very fortunate. Will Lewis was formerly the chief executive and publisher of the Wall Street Journal, Dow Jones. He's a brilliant, the most brilliant media executive. I would not have joined. I've been asked to join a number of startups in my career, and I've always turned those opportunities down. But when Will asks, you kind of have to think differently. So I was incredibly fortunate to have Will alongside me. For me, Sonny, it was useful that also he was a friend. That was actually quite useful. What I found hardest is that you don't have guaranteed income. I'd come from a business where there was guaranteed income. And I'd never had to think so carefully about every pound and every cent that we spent. Will also correctly, but made it a little harder for us because he said we're launching not just in the UK, but also in the US. And that meant not only culture-wise, journalism is different in America from the UK, but also, frankly, legally, we're incorporated in the US, we're incorporated in the UK. Just adds a layer of complexity to what we were doing, that we had a London and a New York office. So that is difficult. It's not bad or negative. It's just hard work. You had to concentrate. We went on an investor round with a deck and a narrative. We had an incredibly strong hypothesis about we need a new news and this is why, which people really engaged with. We were actually oversubscribed for our series A, or pre-A really to get us going. So those were hard. What I found most delightful is working. Average age of our newsrooms is 25 in America and in London, in New York and in London. We are incredibly fortunate that Associated Press, 176 years old, world-renowned news provider, was our partner, invested in us, supported us. ITN supported us at the beginning. National World, publisher of Scott on Sunday, where I used to work all those years ago. These things come around. Scotsman, Sheffield Star were supportive. We've helped them as well, launching them on TikTok, looking at their YouTube strategy, et cetera, et cetera. So we had a great kind of network of people, but what was most brilliant was working with young teams. And I think the key, I initially was sort of, Will and I were of the idea, it needs Will and I to set this thing up with our other co-founders, Ryan Beheshti, Dion Bailey, and Eleanor Breen, the five of us. Brilliant colleagues, all with deep understanding of the media industry. So we were the five. It needed us to set the thing up and be the outside facing to investors, to the industry, et cetera, policymakers, people we wanted to work with. And we should get out of the way of the journalism, let them run the journalism. But actually, I realized over time that it's a partnership, actually, is what you need. It's not about Generation X, my generation, getting out of the way. It's about aligning the skills and passions and experience of young people with the skills, passions, and experience of the older generations. And both together are the secret sauce, maybe. I talk about intergenerational sympathy, not intergenerational conflict. And I think that's a really important thing that I learned. I was much more, we need to get off the mountaintop and let new people onto the mountaintop. And a lot of young people say to me, no, hang on. We're on a journey as well. We need it to be together. You can't just kind of leave the football pitch. And I think that's been the most enjoyable thing, is really learning. I've learned, this sounds a horrible cliche, well, it sounds cliched. I've learned so much in the last nearly 3 years I've been doing this now, from my young colleagues who have grown so much, we've all grown so much together, from how they have tested me on the way I think about what is journalism. And I think that's really helped.
And to end, Kamal, for those who have been intrigued by this amazing story of your childhood through your amazing adventures through media and your huge success, you're also an author. You've written an autobiography about your mom.
I was very fortunate, Mark. I mean, as you say, well, sorry, as I was saying, the BBC was an amazing experience. And also, of course, it gave you platforms that I never imagined I would have. And right back to the start of our conversation, we spoke about writing and the power of writing and my love of writing. And I was very fortunate to be offered the opportunity to write. It was autobiographical, but it was really to try and write about the immigrant experience in the UK from the point of view of someone who is mixed black, has a proud African heritage from Sudan and a proud white heritage from Yorkshire. I am the genuine North-South bringing together. And I was fortunate enough to be asked to reflect on that and to, you know, part autobiography, absolutely right, and part sort of disquisition on where is Britain on this issue of race and identity, 50 years on from the Enoch Powell speech. So yes, The Life and Times of a Very British Man, published by Bloomsbury, was a highlight of my period at the BBC and would not have happened with the BBC. The BBC were very supportive. I took some time off from the BBC to publish the book. It created, I hope, helpful conversations in this space. And again, it was all about partnership and understanding. I think for me, Mark, that notion of sympathy between different interests is really important. And the news movement has, what I'm so fortunate about is I've been able to live through the news movement, what that has meant to me as an individual. We are non-partisan. We try and take a nuanced view as far as we can. We know our own prejudices and privileges that play into everything we do. And our success, you know, we have grown to over 1.5 million followers. We get to tens of millions of young people every month. I hope our success has come from, I believe our success has come from that notion of the world is complicated. We don't want to tell you what to think. We want to help you think, and by helping you think, help you navigate the world. And those simple ideas, which really have been with me all my career and have been with Will all his career and are with many of the great editors and journalists I've met through my career, it's part of the DNA, I think, of great journalism, is that notion of help the world to think, hold power to account, help people navigate the world. Is the job of the great journalist. And if I've achieved a little bit of that on my journey, then I am very proud. And I was very fortunate to be able to write a little bit of what I've learned through my career through the book I was able to write.
So for all of you listening, I would thoroughly recommend The Life and Times of a Very British Man. And I would also highly recommend going on to Kamal's new business, looking at the news in a whole new way. So the news movement, you can find it online, you can find it in all kinds of social media. And Kamal, thank you. You have been a huge influence on the United Kingdom through all the writing that you've done over many years, covering so many amazing events, being at the BBC, but also now striking out and doing something new. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and we all wish you continued success. Thank you.
Mark, thank you so much for such a brilliant conversation.
To listen to more episodes and find out how to get happy in your working life, head to workall.co. Work happier.